Today's episode of A Novel Podcast is sponsored by Audible. And today's novel, Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, is available through audible.com's audiobook library. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook from that library by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You are listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined today by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Jack and Sam. Today we're discussing Little Women, an 1868 novel by American author Louisa May Alcott. The book tells the story of the March family, father and mother Margaret and Robert, and their four daughters, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy. The story focuses on the lives of these four sisters, and the interactions they have with each other, as well as the lives they live on their own, focusing on each sister in turn, and giving them their own fleshed-out story. Fair warning, we will be discussing spoilers and ruining the plot of this novel, so if you haven't read it yet, I would suggest coming back at a future date. So I'd like just to simply start by asking what everybody thought about this novel. Let's go ahead and start with Jack. Jack, what did you think of this book?
It took me a very long time to finish it. I thought, really, Joe was the only character I liked. So anytime we weren't on Joe, I just didn't want to read it. So that's what kind of it took me. That's what took me longer to get through it. I really liked the ending, or the last maybe 25% of the book. And I would actually like to read the sequel, Joe. I think it's called Joe's Boys. I don't know if anyone else has read it, but I'd be, if you have, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
I haven't read it, but that is the name.
And Sam, how about yourself?
Well, you know, I read this book when I was a kid, and I forgot it for a reason. I really did not enjoy Little Women. It was very similar to how you felt, Jack. I felt like it was just, unless we were kind of talking about Joe, and even then, Joe was just the most tolerable character. The rest of them, I guess maybe just looking at it through modern eyes, the rest of them just seem so silly. Like they're major concerns didn't seem all that major, and I'm sure they were for the times, but it just wasn't something I could relate to, so I just wasn't something I was really, I wasn't feeling Little Women too much, but I can understand why at the time it was popular and why it's endured. It just was definitely not my cup of tea.
I kind of feel like I need you to explain to me why it was popular at the time, because it was kind of dry toast with dry sauce.
That's exactly how I feel myself, but I feel like a lot of it, like, oh, just buckle down and work. Sometimes circumstances get hard. Like, it kind of speaks to that spirit that was in America at the time, which was enterprising and working hard and making sure that we're, you know, keeping our nose to the grindstone and staying pure and pay. I think that, you know, for the times, it makes sense because those things were being reinforced as
right.
Proper things of society. So I can see why at the time it was popular, because it's relatable. Everybody's struggling at that time with those things. But as time has gone on, looking at it through, like I said, through my own modern eyes, it's not an interesting read. But I can understand why for a while it was. It makes sense to me. But not now. I wouldn't pick it up again. I wouldn't pick it up again if I reread a book.
Right. I guess that's what I struggled with. I can see that it would be popular at the time. It just seems to have such a long, enduring fan base.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems a little surprising to me.
I think it may less so as time is going on. I think it may less now than it has in the past up until now. But all of these girls are dreamers, and who can't relate to being a dreamer at some point in time and being young and you know, all of them kind of have the dreamer, even if their dreams are a little superficial to our tastes.
That's true. And they were fairly strong female characters,
mm-hmm.
for the most part.
Joe
was. But even Meg, I mean, I didn't...
Was that the youngest? No, Meg was the oldest.
No, Meg was the oldest, who kind of liked, what was the John... Mr.
The guy next door.
The guy next door.
Did she like him?
Well, She didn't like him until her aunt was like, don't marry that guy. And then she was like, oh, John.
I know. It felt to me that Meg's story arc was marry out of spite and you'll be happy for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, there was that one point in the middle where she wasn't super happy.
Yeah, marry right out of spite and you'll be happy. As long as it's married right, though.
Oh, marry right. I see.
Yeah. Marry right. As long as it's somebody with money and society, then you'll be happy. All that other stuff like love and compatibility and attractiveness, that stuff's not important. It's marry right for society is how I took Meg's story. And you'll be happy.
I did laugh really hard at the opening of chapter 5, which was right after Meg got married, and it starts chapter 5, domestic experiences. Like most other young matrons, Meg began her married life with a determination to be a model housekeeper. John should find his home a paradise. He should always see a smiling face. Should fare sumptuously every day and never know the loss of a button. And it made me laugh so hard because that's... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm such a crummy wife if those are the standards.
Yeah.
Like, oh, really falling short. Sorry about that.
My jelly has never come out properly, so I feel like I must be a crummy wife as well.
Yeah, well, she brought so much love, energy, and cheerfulness to the work that she could not but succeed. Yeah, just not quite. I've made good jelly before.
You must be a better wife than I.
Well, I don't think I've ever sewn a button.
Oh, I can't sew buttons.
No, they're the worst.
How do you have trouble sewing buttons?
I know. My husband can sew buttons, and I can't. He also knows how to use a sewing machine, and I can't.
Well, I'm just flabbergasted that you don't know how to sew a button. It seems like such a simple thing. You just go in and out the hole a half a dozen times, and then you circle it around and tie it off.
Have you seen him sew a button, Sarah?
Yeah, Russ totally sews buttons. He can use a sewing machine, and he made his mom curtains, and he made a little cover for our microphone. Yeah, he's awesome.
Sewing machines are also extremely easy to figure out once
he's a great wife.
I can't get it threaded.
That's the worst part, yeah. Anyway. I will concur with, I think, the rest of the room that says that this was not a particularly enjoyable book to modern audiences. And I'd like to agree, yeah, that Joe was far and away the best character in the book.
Easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to add how much I really disliked Amy.
Oh, I did too.
Oh, that's the one I mistook Meg for a minute ago. Amy was the one who was Mary Wright. Meg was the one married for love. I mixed the two up. Yeah, I could understand why you didn't.
I'm not sure. See, that's just it. I'm not sure about it because Meg. Let's talk about the marriages while we're on topic. Okay, so we got Meg and Joe and Amy. So
Beth.
Well, Beth never got married.
Dead Beth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should feel worse about that. I don't.
I don't know. Okay, so I guess we're all going to be pretty comfortable here at laughing viciously at these characters who probably don't actually deserve our laughter. Am I right?
Sorry, Little Women.
And, you know, does anybody else feel that little bit of guilt? But, nah, I don't care about it. It can be a classic in another day type thing. I mean.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
Like.
Yeah.
Hard.
But let's go ahead and talk about the marriages. Okay. So I think we can leave Joe's on the shelf for now. But if we compare and contrast the marriage that Amy has to Theodore Lawrence and Meg has to the nameless tutor.
John.
Sure, John.
John something.
Yeah. If we look, Meg gets married first, very early on compared to the other two. And she's thinking about how she might like this guy. He very much likes her. He's pursuing her, and she's resolutely determined, I am not going to say yes. So they have the conversation, right? And she says, I'll think about it, but maybe in a year's time.
Yeah, but then it literally took her 5 minutes.
After her aunt comes in and says, don't you dare marry that guy. If you do, you're not getting one red cent out of me, right?
Right.
He eavesdrops on them, and she says, oh, aunt, I'll marry who I want, and yes, I like him very much. And so him eavesdropping hears this, and says, oh, you do care for me. This is wonderful. And now she's stuck in a spot. And rather than, I don't know, speaking up or and just saying, oh, John, I was just angry. Yes, I like you, but I'm still too young or something reasonable. Just says, okay, yeah, let's get married. But then winds up having a great marriage and a great life.
Well, there was that one time he brought a friend home. That was very bad.
Yeah, that was very Three's Company. Very I Love Lucy, wasn't it?
Well, the whole thing is I Love Lucy. Yeah, she could have been like, oh, hey.
Well, I don't know. Lucy,
can't believe you heard that. Okay, maybe
Lucy
not.
Was
I love Lucy.
Way more ditzy than her.
Maybe like Everybody Loves Raymond.
The whole situation. Know. You're saying that situation.
Yes, the entire situation was sitcom-y.
Yeah, that was more like Make Room for Daddy.
Nobody has watched that.
No.
My Three Sons.
Still no.
No.
Oh, I know.
Walton's?
Full House.
Ah, that one I've seen.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, wholesome family fun.
Yes, I got that too. That's definitely wholesome family fun. Little slapsticky. Haha, this is funny. The jelly. Haha, like.
Okay, so I can understand. In fact, a lot of this reminded me a bit of the Prydain Chronicles, where it's, you know, every couple of moments there's a life lesson built into the story. The difference here is the Prydain Chronicles had a story, whereas this one was just, oh, don't bring limes to school, the teacher will scold you.
Yeah, there just wasn't a lot of point.
Yeah.
Why am I still reading this?
Yeah. I kept waiting for a Chekhov's gun or a moment of time when I was going to go, ooh, that's going to be important later, and I don't think I saw a single one.
Like, the whole first part of the book, I just wanted it to end. It just did not end fast enough.
Okay, it's tomorrow. Let's do the exact same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's tomorrow again. Oh, I bet Joe's going to do something saucy with Lori. Okay, it wasn't really that saucy. She just wrote him a note and told him to brush his hair. Hmm.
So that's Meg's marriage, which is interesting in a mild way. But then Amy...
Ugh.
Her marriage. Let's start with her marriage. What was it about her marrying Lori that was, I don't know, did Sam, did you feel like that was...
I felt like that whole thing seemed very rushed to me. It seemed very much like all of a sudden this happened. And I didn't feel Amy and Lori together. And after they got together, you know, they painted the picture of, once again, a perfect marriage so long as your wife is devoted to your husband. And, you know, they do paint that picture. But I don't know, just something about it. It was almost, I don't know, it was just strange to me. I didn't expect for Lori and Joe to get together because it didn't seem like they had that kind of relationship. But I wouldn't have anticipated him moving on to just another sister.
Right. Like a little contrived. And kind of, if I can't have Joe, I guess I'll take this one.
Well, that to me was the great mystery of the novel. Watching Lori interact with these four ladies. Which one is he going to marry? Because he's not going to marry more than one, but he's definitely going to marry one of them.
Right.
So you definitely thought Lori was going to marry one of them?
Oh, yeah.
From the beginning?
Mm-hmm. As soon as a boy was introduced, based on the genre alone, I felt like it was an inevitability.
That's true.
Short of him, like, proposing to one, going off to war, and then being killed.
I was thinking they were going to bring a little society girl in for him.
I suppose.
You know, add a little drama, spice it up with another personality to the mix and make her have to get used to being around the Little Women. Like, I don't know, I just thought it would have been more interesting if they would have brought a different dynamic and kept Lori as one of the brothers and not married him into the family. If you know what I mean?
I could have seen that.
I just didn't like the way he ended up marrying into the family ended up wrapping up. Amy seemed like she did it because it was the right thing to do, and she would marry into a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
Even though she said no, you know, we kind of have the idea that that's what she was in for. She was in for money with her first romantic interest, and I don't think that's the only thing she was in for, but she certainly didn't forget about it when considering Lori during that little courting period.
So did any of the characters have any real faults?
There are a bunch of Mary Sues, which is why all of them are interesting, because...
Yes.
Well, pointed out the most shallow, not really fault-type faults.
Right. Like, Amy was super shallow. That was kind of her fault. So she was going to marry for money, but then she realized she shouldn't.
Yeah,
but she's still married for money.
But she's still married for money.
But she ended up working it out, and they're all in love, and... She's a happy housewife, so even though she married for money, that marriage ended up working out for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. And then Joe was temperamental, but she managed to contain it.
Uh-huh. But even then, like, that was the only redeeming character of the whole story.
Right.
And they made it seem amoral and that she had to temper her spirit.
Right, and she was very definitely not temperamental, just had opinions that she was willing to share, which is apparently offensive in 1860.
Yeah, yeah. We're supposed to be seen and not heard as far as women go, you know?
Did Meg have any... she couldn't make jelly. I guess that's a problem.
Oh, and she spent too much money.
Yeah. The oldest, so she missed being rich. She remembers, she missed it the most because she grew up being rich. The other girls, they came around and they were rich for a little bit of their beginning childhood, but not like Meg was. Meg had it for a minute, so she was used to being a little bit more well off. So she spent her husband's money, trying to keep up appearances because she was vain.
That's true. Okay, Meg was a little bit vain, and then Beth was just a saint, except she died.
Yeah.
So was that her character flaw? Tuberculosis?
Even at the end of her own life, she questioned whether her life was worth anything because she didn't do very much.
Hmm.
You know, she brought what joy she could to the people around her, but she really had no ambition or no goals other than to stay home and care for others.
So Beth, at the end of her life, probably infuriated me more than any character in this book.
Yeah.
Because as she lay dying, she said to Joe, "You have to give up your life and take care of mother and father now. That has to happen."
Yeah.
And that really sort of lit me on fire. So you're going to saddle your sister with either taking care of your parents and not living her own life, or immeasurable guilt for the rest of her days for not doing that?
Yeah.
Now, luckily, Joe kind of handled that.
That was a theme throughout the whole book, too, giving up. I mean, because, okay, let's think about it. Joe had her writing. You know, so that's a very artistic...
Yes.
Expression.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, she basically was told that she had to give it up because, you know, she's being selfish. She had to stay home and take care of her parents, or the professor didn't like what she was writing about and how, you know, moral.
Right.
Lori had to give up his music because the grandfather didn't like it because his mother was a musician, Lori's mother. Amy gives up her sketching at the end because she couldn't be one of the greats. I mean, it just was all about, which is funny because Joe was kind of
autobiographical.
Thank you. Joe was modeled off of Louisa May Alcott. So it just seemed odd to me that you have this female writer in the 1800s and she's having this character give up her, I mean, she comes back to it, but, you know, I mean, it just seems like that was kind of one of the morals of the story, was how pursuing art is selfish.
Yes.
Well, it definitely seems like it was one of those books that was supposed to speak to the people, the regular people, instead of the glamorous people or the quirky hero or whoever. It was supposed to be for the regular people. It seems like it's one of those books that's like, be happy with your lot in life, poor people, because you're pious. And if you're good, then it's okay. As long as you're good, it doesn't matter if you're this or that or the other. And to a point, that's true, but it also is kind of one of those things that it almost made it, it was almost like a comfort for complacency, it seemed like. You know, you're not going to be great anyway, so you might as well just give up your art. You know, it's one of those things that it seemed like it spoke to the people who are regular people and feel like they missed out in some way, shape, or form. But they should be happy about it because they're good people anyway. Be happy about it. You know, sacrifice is good. It makes you good. You know, it kind of seems like it speaks to the times. It was a hard time for a lot of people trying to scratch their way around in that particular period in history, you know?
Yes. I think it was... I mean, there were good themes. There were themes of sacrifice. And I think... Well, I definitely think that in modern society that should be more of a theme. I don't think that people today sacrifice enough. We do tend to be more selfish and more self-centered, but for goodness sakes, these people never thought of themselves.
No.
Well, there was that whole theme in the very, or that whole scene in the very beginning of the book where they've worked hard for a couple of months in a row and they decided they're going to take a week off and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother, you know, makes a whole point of saying, "Oh, make sure you don't do any work." And tries to drill into them how incredibly boring and tedious that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the first 4 days were great.
Well, I think they just... the thing is, I think they just did it wrong.
Right.
Rather than taking a week to recreate, you know,
they still restricted themselves during the week to...
They wouldn't even... Okay, so go out and why don't you try, instead of drawing one picture a week, why don't you try and draw one picture a day? Spend your time writing. You know, just turn your life upside down for a week. Vacation. Vacate the way that you should. And they didn't. They indulged in utter sloth.
Right. It was sort of an example of, like, a scientific experiment that on paper seems good, but you actually missed a lot of variables here that would have been important.
Yeah. I'd like to talk a little bit more about Jo and her writing, and then specifically, because this is a podcast about books, let's talk about her books. The one thing I wanted to point out was, if you remember the scene where she goes to see that lecture on Egyptology, and while she's waiting for the lecture to begin, she sees a young man reading a newspaper, and he lets her borrow the paper, and she reads the story, and she comments about how it's different than what she's used to reading. And the quote is, "For the story belongs to that class of light literature on which the passions have a holiday. And when the author's invention fails, a grand catastrophe clears the stage of one half of the dramatist's personae, leaving the other half to exult over their downfall." And that inspires her to write stuff that sells and to make money. And she's now earning a living writing, and after a while decides she doesn't like the critiques that she's getting or the praise that she's getting. And so she decides, after a short while of a short hiatus, to start penning again under a pseudonym or perhaps as anonymous. And so she's making quite a bit of money as a writer, the profession that she wants. And yet her the future fiancé says, are you sure you want to do this, in kind of a subtle way? And she says, yeah, you know, this is absolutely right. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be staying true to my art. And I found the whole thing confusing, because I'm wondering, how smutty was what she was writing? How awful is it? I mean...
It probably wasn't smutty at all. I mean, it's...
Relative to the day. Like, how sensationalist is it? How base is your writing? Because I would look at something... You know, we don't all read the highest of high literature. We read literature that challenges us as readers, sometimes, and then we'll switch to Janet Ivanovich for a little while.
I knew you were going to bring her up.
And I see no reason why you can't, you know, sometimes I watch very challenging films, and then other times I just want to watch an episode of Cheers. So I see no reason why she should feel bad writing some base pop fiction that isn't in her style, if that's what makes you money.
Well, I feel like this is another example of, like, the science experiment, and they just missed a few variables.
Right. What did you all think of that?
Yeah, I think you're on point. Like, put some checks and balances in. But you're paying the bills, you're making money, you're proud of yourself, mm-hmm. you're creating a product that people want. I mean, sometimes you gotta Dean Koontz it up.
Well, I mean, I think about, what if you were a fantastic person who made, say, $120,000 a year and gave $30,000 away to a good charity, and you worked hard and you brought your family up right, but at the same time you're working for Philip Morris. Do you have to say to yourself, well, you know, I'm doing something that people want, they're making their own decisions, but I'm not proud of the work I'm doing? Is that the decision that Jo made? Or do you think that she was really, like, did she make that decision for herself or for society? And does it make a difference why she made that decision?
I think, being in the time that it was in, a lot of stuff was done for society. It kind of goes back to the sacrifice element of society that we were talking about. A lot of stuff is done for society and for appearances. It's a long-running theme in a lot of books. It's a long-running theme in a lot of movies. I think she gave it up for society. I don't think she gave it up out of any moralistic, oh my goodness, I'm writing action novels and I'm a woman, or smutty novels and I should be using a pseudonym, or however she decided to do it. I don't think necessarily it was the content. I think part of it was the content, but it's more that she was a woman writing the content she was writing. Mm. And she's supposed to be, you know, if she's going to be an author, she needs to be one who's going to write great literature, as she ended up being. I mean, if the book is autobiographical, Louisa May Alcott ended up being a great of literature. If she was going to do it, that's what she needed to be. She couldn't be a penny writer for the magazines because that's too base for her. Just like Amy couldn't be simply a little sketch artist. She had to be one of the greats. It was something that, you know, you could tell was something for society, not necessarily for her. She wanted to be part of the mix for me is what I got from it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think, I feel like it speaks to, should you create something that you're pleased with? Like in Amy's case, for example, when she decided to not be an artist because she couldn't be one of the greats, she sort of ceased creating entirely.
Yeah.
Like, well, I'll just be a really good housewife instead then. And she wasn't even a good housewife. She was just a wife because they had people to do the housewifing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Servants.
Yes. So, I think you could argue that Amy was the weakest character.
I don't think you need to argue that.
Well,
I think it's apparent.
I suppose. But, I mean, on the surface, she had a tremendous amount of happiness. And, you know, she was satisfied with her life.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was sort of an interesting conclusion to draw on Alcott's part.
Hmm.
Like, shouldn't Amy have wanted some sort of pursuit of her own happiness? Or her own creativity?
Hmm.
Because Alcott did write into all of the sisters some form of creativity. Except maybe Meg. Was she creative? What did she do?
Embroidery.
Right. Oh, yeah. I wonder why I forgot about that. But Joe wrote, Beth played music, Amy drew. You know, they were creative females for the time. But then by the end of the book,
they were all happy housewives, as they should be.
Right.
Hmm.
No? You're not feeling it?
I'm intrigued by that point, but it would also bring up the fact that, well, at least Jo was pursuing literature in some way.
Was she writing? I don't remember. I
know
she had,
she was teaching.
The Little Boy Farm.
No, she was teaching.
Yeah. That's true.
And she was doing it, and I liked how she was teaching to, so I guess this comes back again to better society. She was teaching at a school that taught socialites so that it could be profitable, but also had a grant, endowment, sponsorship, scholarship program that would allow for people who couldn't afford to send their kids to the greatest schools to send the kids to that school.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cute that Granddad, Mr. Lawrence, would make up. Like, oh, hey, this kid just got a scholarship, but he just paid for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was kind of a neat bow on the top of the story, but it also undermined Joe entirely, who very specifically said, I don't want this to happen. And then he was like, oh, well, I know what's best for you, so I'll do it anyway.
Mm. All right, so let's talk a little bit about, I can't think of the word I want to use. Liberation is the only one that comes into my mind in general. And I'm wondering if, at the time that it was written, if this was the kind of book that was exalting women to be more free than society would generally have them to be. And it's only from our perspective as it is, what are we at, 160 years later? 150 years later? 1868. It's 150 years to the... 150 years exactly.
150 years to the year.
All right, so it's 150 years ago.
Wow.
Is that simply the perspective of those 150 years, whereas now it seems like...
I think I know where you're going. So my take on it is I don't feel like it does, though, because even Joe, who is the character that we all seem to like the most because of her spirit, throughout the book, she was portrayed as not prime marriage material.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like it really was discouraging women from having that sort of spirit, where Beth, even though she didn't make it to marrying age, you know, she was the sweet and mild and submissive and those were the qualities that were exalted. Even in the book, those were the qualities that were exalted in women.
Definitely seemed that way. I felt like while I was reading this, I needed more historical perspective with regards to what was expected of females in society. And I think that was an interesting question that you brought up, Russ. Like, how was this received, and how what was the perspective of the average?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was this a really enlightened piece of literature?
Mm-hmm.
And definitely now, I completely agree with you, Jack. Joe was the only interesting character. I mean, that's harsh, especially fully realizing that it's 150 years old. But Joe was the only character that showed some spark and showed some interest and sort of bucked the norm. But yeah, she was definitely represented as not being marriage material. And
well, could you look at it from the other perspective? And I don't know that what I'm about to say is correct. I'm just asking if it is worth considering. In that, here you have Joe, who is portrayed as not marriage material, but then in the end, not only gets a marriage that works very well for her, but is also fairly unconventional by the days, is applauded by the family. You know, everybody in the family liked Professor Bear. And then in addition to that, is happy and productive in her own right, doing much more than simply being a housewife.
True.
Would that marriage have been well received at the time, or would that have been looked down the nose upon, or been looked at down the nose? How do you phrase that?
I would think that what the other sisters did was more relatable, common, and understandable, and what Joe did would have been more not one of those things to look down on, but one of those things that's kind of like a pipe dream. Like, oh, sure, yeah, you can be yourself and have everything wrap up nicely. But really, it actually happens like the rest of the Little Women. It doesn't really happen like Joe all the time. I think it would have been seen as a source of inspiration and optimism, and it would have been a cute little fairy tale. Sure, you can be yourself and you can buck the norms if you want to, but really, the rest of the Little Women are more conventional to what society would have been like at the time. Whether it be marrying poor, marrying rich, either way, you were expected to marry, you're expected to give up your dreams, you're expected to run a household as your role at that time. And Joe would have been, in my mind, would have been more looked at as somebody that's representative of a cute little fantasy, a cute little dream. Like, sure, it all works out for you. That's the optimistic side of it. But I mean, that's kind of just looking at, I don't think she would have been looked down on. I kind of wouldn't see it that way. We all were endeared to Joe for similar reasons, and that's her spirit. I think that might have spoken to people of the time as well.
Okay. Now, I do mean that what if it were not a novel? What if Joe was a real person who had lived her life exactly as it was portrayed in the novel? How would society have actually reacted to that real-life person?
They would have burned her at the stake.
Crazy old lady.
And that's what we do with witches?
That's what they would have burned her at the stake. Well, and it's funny because I always think that if I lived in a different time, I would totally be one of the women who were burned at the stake. Yeah. And so I will say that reading this novel gave me a glimpse of what my life might have actually been like if I had lived in the 1800s, assuming this is a realistic representation of a spirited woman. So I will say it did give me hope that I would have survived the 1800s if I had lived in that time period.
You could have just married an old German guy.
There you go.
Yep.
I can think of worse fates.
Mm-hmm. They did take place in Massachusetts, and that's what we're known for up here.
Oh, that's true. That's where you're at.
Yeah. Louisa May Alcott is actually buried locally to me, where I've been to her gravesite.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
I just found out that Zelda Fitzgerald is buried like 3 miles from here.
Oh, interesting.
I know. That was my interesting fact of the day. Do you feel like it would have been a better novel if Joe had not gotten married?
No, because I did want her to, I don't know, we all need someone to find the body when we die, you know? So someone...
And such a someone, great way to put it.
And someone cool to grow old with. So, and I feel like the professor, even though he was a little, you know, the moral strictness that he had and how he felt of her writing. He did, though, seem like a very nice and caring man with a lot of spirit himself.
Yes.
So I did like that they got together.
I did, too, but I think that's just my pursuit of when I'm reading a book, I expect it to sort of end with a romance, this type of book.
Well, I look at Joe's character in that situation, and I think, well, what if you were a painter and you liked painting? But the only way you could support yourself through painting is by making, you know, like big murals.
John Wayne Gacy clown paintings.
Just, or nudes.
Or just house painting. Like, you know, you got to paint a house and maybe the person wants a floral pattern, a custom floral. Stuff that you're not interested in. And you come along and you meet somebody who is a extremely wealthy stockbroker. They make a lot of money, more money than they know what to do with, and you and they get along really, really well. And now you don't have to worry about painting for money. You can just paint whatever the hell you want to. Is accepting that marriage and accepting the money that comes with it so that you may spend your time pursuing your dreams and not having to worry about making it financially viable, is that not being true to yourself? Or is that being extremely true to yourself? And is that what Joe did?
No, because she liked him, the German.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. You genuinely like this person.
Okay.
You want to spend the rest of your
life
with
him. It's a good stockbroker.
They come with a lot of money, and they would prefer it, or maybe not even that, maybe that's the wrong phrase, would be perfectly happy with you not earning any income on your own and just pursuing your dreams. Is that, you accept that marriage proposal? Is that you being true to yourself? Regardless of gender.
I think that's a highly individual sort of question.
Right, but the question is a parallel to what is happening in these books. In this book with these characters.
I don't think so, though, because even though Laurie and... Are you talking about Laurie and Joe?
Okay, it's a parallel in that look at what they actually do after they get married versus what they could have been doing.
But Russ, even though they were great friends, they were both highly spirited people. They were butting heads and fighting all the time. So I don't think it is a good parallel.
Who are you referring to?
I thought we were talking about Joe and Laurie.
I'm talking about anybody. Look at Amy. Amy married Laurie and could well have, instead of just being socialite wife, could have really pursued her art.
But you were saying the parallel was between two people who got along. And even though they were friends, they did not get along all the time. They fought a lot.
Yes.
I thought you were talking about Joe and Laurie.
I am.
I am
too. I said, and not just any two people. I'm talking about people. It could have been Meg, Amy, or Joe, or anybody else in society.
Yeah, but Lori is the only one that offers the stockbroker life.
I know, and if a rich guy that I really like asked me to marry him, yeah.
Right?
And so if that,
me up for that novel.
And if like that happens with any of these characters, are they not being true to themselves by accepting that marriage proposal?
Well, I think we sort of talked about that earlier with Amy.
I think Amy went for that.
Yes. But I think that was sort of true to herself. That was her goal from day one, was to enter society. So she gave up her art. And I think that was, through my modern lens, I think that that was sort of foolish. And that Alcott could have written a stronger character by having her keep her creative elements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Amy, in light of the novel that I read... No, pursued exactly what she wanted. Oh, I didn't realize it was right here all along.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted to marry into society. She was planning on marrying Fred, the other guy.
Yeah.
And really, I think she would have if Laurie hadn't just turned up in Paris or wherever they were.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of changed her mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at, like, Joe paralleled with Laurie,
mm-hmm.
like Jack was saying, no, they were both very spirited. They didn't get along, and it doesn't parallel the scenario you laid out. If you look at Joe with the professor, that doesn't parallel what you laid out, because the professor, doesn't offer that stockbroker lifestyle. And then Meg and John definitely wasn't rich. So Meg allegedly married for love, but really she married out of spite. But mm-hmm. I guess you could say it was love, because that's the way it's intended to be interpreted, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then Amy married exactly what she wanted the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Just the rosy, glossy ending for everyone is irksome to me. And I guess you're reading a novel, and that's sort of the point that everyone...
Well,
Beth... In this book in particular, the point was that everyone came out happy except for poor dead Beth.
Yes.
But, I mean, in real life, if you put a modern twist on Little Women, I think that Jo would have been the one that came out happy mm-hmm. with the professor, because she sort of pursued her dream
mm-hmm.
and was spirited and did what she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, poetic justice would have kind of had the other two being miserable. Not that
yeah.
Pushing that I... on them.
Yeah.
But... I think that would have been, you know, Meg marrying out of spite and Amy marrying frivolously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been a more poetic ending.
Hmm. Well, what did Meg actually want out of life?
Yeah. What did any of them want? They were boring.
Does anybody know? What did Meg actually want?
I don't know, do we still have you guys?
They all seem to me to want the same thing, which is to grow up to have, you know, the mom instilled in them to grow up to be happy. Grow up and get married and be happy. Because marriage and happiness for ladies were the same thing back then.
Right.
So, I mean, that's kind of what it seemed like to me, is that Meg's wants were the same as all of their wants, to grow up and get married and be housewifely and happy. Even if they had, you know, other interests, as soon as those other interests weren't going to manifest themselves in a specific way, the only other option was to get married, and that would make them happy. The worst thing in the world would have been for them to stay unmarried. You know, even towards the end, spirited Jo, who said she was never going to fall in love, even she started feeling, oh, I wish I could marry myself. You know, So I think Meg's wants and needs were all very, even if they all manifested themselves in different ways, it all boiled down to, you know, be a happy housewife. I think what Meg wanted. I think that's, you know, she wanted to have a little bit of money, not necessarily society, but a little bit of money so she wasn't poor, and she wanted to be a housewife. She wanted to be like her mom. They all did.
That's probably true. Yeah.
So this is interesting. The book was actually published in two parts. So part one was the first volume, and then part two didn't come out until a year later.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it says that after the publication of the first volume, a lot of girls were writing to the author, to Alcott, asking her who the girls end up marrying. And because you're right, at that time, that was the end goal. I mean, women got married and they became housewives and they had children and that was it. So I don't know, maybe that's sort of why Meg was written the way she was written, to appeal to that set of girls and then...
appeal to the masses.
Hmm.
Yeah, and then you see a different way of life in... I mean...
These were all depictions of everyday life, even if it were different in different ways. These are all depictions of everyday life of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Each and every sister was a different aspect. So, you know, that's why I say it kind of speaks to a lot of the values of the time, because each and every sister, even though they were different, they all were very similar in that they were regular people. None of them grew up to be, aside from Jo, who grew up to be Alcott, Lucy May Alcott, none of them, you know, grew up to be the next Michelangelo or whatever it is that they had the fantasies of being. They all mostly grew up to be regular, everyday people. So that's why they should be satisfied with work and being a housewife, because that's what you can expect out of life. That's what most people get. Delusions of grandeur tend to be a little bit frowned upon, not quite immoral, but bordering on immoral, because it's not likely for most people, and it's vain and prideful to be that. So it very much seems like the four types of women were very much the average day-to-day type girls that you know what I mean, that would be writing in and asking, how does their story wrap up? Do they wind up married because I see myself in Joe or Meg or Amy or whatever?
Or Dead Beth. That's what made me laugh. Like the four types. It's like the spirited one, the housewifey one, the artistic one, or the dead one.
Or the dead one, which was also very common.
Which,
in the
1800s.
Realistically, that was probably the most
but she
common.
Did have her own aspect. She did have her own personality, too. You know, she was the big
personality is a strong word for what she had going on.
Well, I mean, her lack of personality was her personality, I suppose.
I will admit, I had very, very strong emotions about holding the baby while it died. I was a mess.
Yeah, that part got me. You're right. Although, can I tell them about your dirty secret, Russ?
My dirty secret?
Yeah. We discussed this.
She was somebody who was caring and, you know, a little bit. She was a self-sacrifice person. She was nurturing. She, even though she passed on, she did have her own personality, which was...
She did. It was just boring.
All right, Sarah, what were you saying?
Russ's dirty secret. We were talking...
Yeah. Oh, about Amy. All right, so... Let me preface it this way, okay? When Joe, being perfectly sensible, pisses Amy off, I forget exactly what happens, but Joe does something perfectly rational, maybe a little bit abrupt or brass, lacking in tact, but perfectly rational. Amy hauls off and burns her book of stories.
Now, yes!
Granted, yeah. I have to say, Joe, that was a pretty foolish thing, not having a backup. You should always have a copy of things that are important. But at the same time, that was incredibly rash and mean of Amy to do. So that immediately made me hate Amy.
Yeah,
horrible.
And so
I feel like another little piece of background is when we are reading books for a novel podcast, we try not to discuss them a lot so that our discussion happens here on air. But we had a casual like, so, hey, Little Women, where you at? And Russ was like, man, was I happy when Amy fell in the water. And it made me laugh really hard because I was too. I know we were supposed to really think Joe was a terrible human being, but Amy deserved it.
Oh my, I would never have forgiven her. I haven't forgiven her.
Right?
It wasn't even my book, and I read this book months ago, and I haven't forgiven her.
Yeah, Amy's the worst.
Yeah, Amy was the worst. She was my least favorite.
But then I guess she grew up, and now we have to like her, so...
We don't have to like anybody we don't want to like.
Now, what did you think about the father?
Oh, yeah. He was there.
Now, what was the significance? Robert was his name. Now, what was the significance of his absence for the beginning of the book? Was that just story so that there was a MacGuffin of some kind? Or was there a reason that was happening?
I think it was significant in the time period to have...
Yeah.
Six women interacting. I think that's a really important thing that this book brings to the table that I forget what the effect is, but many, many, many of the conversations were females talking to females.
Mm-hmm.
What's the...
Yeah.
If you look at... Oh, I can't remember this and I should have looked it up beforehand. But television shows... until very recently, the vast majority of them, like all throughout the 80s and 90s, even if there is a strong female character, she's always partnered with a male. Mm-hmm. So it's rare to see two female characters interacting with no men on the screen.
Mm.
So I think it's interesting that this book had a lot of that.
Mm.
Females interacting with females with no male influence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's interesting, and I'm wondering if that's one of the reasons... that it was so popular during the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has to sort of stand alone in that aspect.
Now, looking at the lives of these ladies from 150 years ago, trying to discern if this was, you know, how accurate it was or what it felt like.
Yes.
So from the men's perspective, I'm interested in what was a man's life like at the time? Somebody like Laurie who just, you know, jaunts off to college and then does whatever he feels like after he's done there, as opposed to John the Tudor.
Who
works hard and can barely support his family, and if his wife buys a dress, he has to go without a coat.
I feel like the men's role, a lot of it was work, because didn't Amy look down on Lori when she was like, look at your hand. It doesn't look like it's seen a day of work in its life. It's lily white like a lady's, blah, blah, blah. It was all about, you know, you need to be working hard. And that, I think, was a lot of the men's role, was to work hard and, you know, provide good foundation for the rest of the family to be able to do, you know, what the women were doing, which is tend the home and make sure that everybody was comfortable and being raised right. It kind of, you know, it's unfortunately it cheapens that, because, you know, naturally men have other roles and other interests as well. But it seems like it kind of defined those two roles is, you know, like that women were growing up to be housewives and men were growing up to work and provide for their wives. That's what they're supposed to do. Mm. And it was, if you're intelligent and working hard, that's okay. If you're rich and working hard, that's good. That's even better, because it speaks to character. You know, it was brought up several times that a man's role is to lead the family in the book, you know, from Robert's, you know, teaching the girls a certain way and being the guiding force. As soon as he came back into the picture, you know, even though the talks with Marmee were still fruitful, they were mostly centered on what Robert had to say and his opinion on the subject. You know, it all kind of boils down to the men being the worker and the leader. That was their role, just like the women's role is defined, was to be a happy wife. It was, you know, if for, you know, happy wife, respect the sacrifice that the man makes of working, is kind of how the role seemed in my view of what I was seeing.
I think that's why the beginning of the book was significant, in that Robert wasn't there.
Right. Mm. It established,
you're losing that leadership element, mm-hmm. and you see that they can still function.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Very good.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I just have one further question, and that is, Pilgrim's Progress is mentioned quite a bit. Have any of you read that, and do you think there's any significance to how often it's been mentioned? And if you haven't read it, are you interested in reading it?
I haven't read it, and I'm not interested in reading it.
Yup.
Same here. I'm sure it was significant for the time, but not for me.
Yeah, I made the attempt to read it years
Did
ago.
You?
Yeah, I found it extraordinarily boring.
Really?
Yeah.
As boring as the rest of us Fine Little Women?
Right? Hard to say. First off, it was about 10 years ago. Second off, I read it in paper, not in audio.
Mm.
And thirdly, I've been wanting to read it because I understand that it was an influence of C.S. Lewis's. And I really like the Outer Space trilogy.
So is it, it is a religious book, correct?
I don't know how to describe it. Yes is the best answer, but it's more than just that, but not much more.
Okay.
It depends, and it really depends on your perspective. But having only read the first 30 pages or so, I am not an expert.
You're the most expert in this group.
I am the resident expert.
Although Jack knew that it was religious, so you get some points too.
I mean... Yeah.
Didn't even know that.
Guess.
Was it about a pilgrim and perhaps some progress that he made?
Well, you know, the pilgrimage, the religious pilgrimages, and then, you know, there was so many religious undertones in Little Women. I just figured you're giving me too much credit.
Okay. All right. You know, that's interesting. There were religious undertones, but no overt religion. Did they ever talk about going to church or... Even the marriages took place.
It's an interesting point.
In the front rooms.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Amy flirted with religion a little bit when she talked with Estelle, the Catholic servant that was in the aunt's house. And she talked about the family is Protestant. And the dad did read from the Bible. Robert did read from the Bible. It didn't seem like they were habitual churchgoers, and, you know, it didn't seem like they were evangelists where they were, like, all about the church or Puritans or anything.
Right.
But it definitely seemed like there was a strong, not only strong religious undertone to the book, the family did have a foundation in religion.
Okay.
So I'm reading the description on Goodreads about the Pilgrim's Progress, and I love it. I'm quoting, one of the most entertaining allegories of faith ever written. I'm laughing.
The description of the book is pretty funny.
Was that review written in, like, 1892?
Well, maybe it's simply making an assumption that any allegory of faith is going to be extremely boring, so it's a low bar. Although, if you haven't read the Outer Space Trilogy, you must.
I must.
Yeah, all of Lewis's books have a strong religious undertone to them. Mm. All of the Narnias did. I read all the Screwtape
letters. Well, this is written by John Bunyan.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I believe somebody said that Lewis was inspired by this book. So I guess that's kind of why I was tying it back to that. It's just, you can kind of see that it, when I was reading the description, I actually remember my mom's read this book.
Hmm.
My mom's read everything, though, so that's not, I mean, I definitely remember seeing this laying around and it being too much for me to bite off, so I wasn't interested in trying to chew it. It definitely looks like it was going to be above where I was interested in reading at the time.
Hmm.
I hear ya.
All right, any other thoughts on Little Women?
I'm glad I read it. And I'm glad it's over.
Concur.
Yeah, I started reading at 1.1 speed on audiobook. And by the end, it was up to 1.6.
Yeah. At 1.5. I couldn't. I read half of it and was like, yeah, I'm going to listen to the rest of this. And did the same thing. It was at 1.5. Made the story drag a little bit less, so, you know.
Yeah, I find it hard to follow the words when it goes that fast. Anything about 1.3, I really struggle internalizing the words, but I needed to shave some hours off of that.
Hours.
Plural, yes. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's it for Little Women. Let's go ahead and do a roundtable. Tell us what you've been reading, and we have no books on the docket, so we have to make some decisions tonight about what we're going to read next.
Okay.
So tell us what you're reading now and what you want to discuss next. And if anything else cool is happening in your life, I'd love to hear about it. We'll start with Jack. Go ahead.
All right. I've got three books going right now. I've got, I don't even know how to pronounce it because I don't speak French, but it's a sort of a Canadian murder mystery type series. So I'm reading the fourth book of it right now. It's really good. I'm halfway through. I'm also reading The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That's my nonfiction that I have going on. And I am making my way through the Jack Reacher novels on audiobook. My mother-in-law gave me like 20 audiobooks from the series. So I'm making my way through those. I'm on book 4 of that as well.
And Sam, go ahead.
I just finished up the Hitchhiker's Galaxy series. I did. I read them all except for So Long and Thanks for the Fish. I'm just starting it, but I read I'm finishing them all. So I got that one on the list, and then finished up Coraline recently, and I've got Magnus Chase, which is yet another Rick Riordan retelling of some of the old myths. This one he's doing the Norse gods. So he does like a retelling of most of them. He's done the Greek gods. He's done the Percy Jackson books. He's the same author of those. And I'm reading the third novel, Magnus Chase. And I think it's called I can't remember what the third one's called. I think it's called The Hammer of Thor. The Gods of Asgard. That's what it's called. Gods of Asgard. So I'm reading that right now too. Got a few of them. Out there, mostly just kind of having some fun and doing some light reading after Little Women, kind of enjoying myself and kind of playing around with the fun stuff in other worlds. That's always a good time to me.
And yourself?
So I am reading Dracula, which is pretty fun. Jack and I talked briefly about it, and you said you couldn't remember what you didn't love, and I think what you didn't love was how loquacious... What's his name? Help.
Bram Stoker?
Bram Stoker?
Not Bram Stoker.
Oh, no, the main guy.
Oh.
Yeah. Van Helsing.
Van Helsing.
Thank you. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, it's coming back.
He can be a little wordy. But overall, I enjoy it. And my suggestion for future read is Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, which is a nonfiction historical novel. I feel like I should read more about American history. In novella form. It's my suggestion. And we're still reading Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets with the kid. I'm still reading. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. And I'm pretty sure it is the weak link in the 7-book series.
Yep. Yeah, it's my least favorite.
Yeah, yeah, same here. Same here. I can't wait till my little one's old enough to give the Harry Potters a read. We just started The Wind in the Willows. And it's since it's a copy that's got pictures in it, it's still keeping her entertained. She's only 3.
Okay.
You know, so it's a copy that still has pictures in it, so she's still keeping entertained. But so far, she seems to have liked it so far. We've gotten through the first chapter. It's my first chapter book that I've read with her.
So I'm trying to see
how long it holds. You know how, you know, when they're small like that, you can't get their attention worth anything.
No.
You know, just a few pages. But she's sitting for it. We're reading it before bedtime, so she's sitting for it. Anything to make bedtime, you know, further and further down. She'll sit through a chapter if we're not sleeping yet. So
yeah, the 4-year-old falls asleep before we finish a chapter in Chamber of Secrets, and they both are sort of saying no. Like, okay, we're going to read Harry Potter, and they're like, no. I'm going to be like, guys, listen, it's going to get so much better. We just have to truck through this.
Yeah, there's, yeah, mine's a little small, so I have to try and get her attention and hold it, which, like I said, she's not a fall asleep during the story type kid. She's a what happens next, I'm staying awake and night type kid.
There's only so much Death Day Party you can read about before you're checked out. Mm. I completely sympathize with my children here. Mm. We're still going to read it.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Daddy? What you reading?
Well, I was waiting patiently for Henry to turn 6 so we can start the Chronicles of Brédain all over again.
2 more years.
And then I'm not reading anything right now. No, that's not true. I'm rereading Mindless Eating. I just started that one again.
I like to mindlessly eat,
right?
No, I like mindful eating. I want to pay every attention to the Chipotle burrito, both of them, that goes in the gullet. I want to enjoy it.
Mm.
And then, no.
No, I enjoy it, trust me.
And beyond that, no, I have nothing else because I've been playing entirely too much Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
I finished Super Mario Galaxy 2. I am almost at 100% completing everything there is to complete in Super Mario 3D World, and I just started Super Mario Odyssey.
Such a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. And finished Bravely Default, which was 55 hours when it probably should have only been about 25, but I still enjoyed it. And Samus Returns, just started that one. So that's my excuse for not reading anything. I got too many video games going on.
I feel like 55 hours but should have been 25 sums up Little Women and Dracula.
Yeah,
we could have really pulled this together a lot quicker, guys.
Yeah, the last chapter in Bravely Default repeats itself several times, and if you're not paying attention, you can have it take entirely too long.
Oh, man.
But as far as books go, the ones on my list, Lonesome Dove.
Oh, yes.
Neil deGrasse Tyson's Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
Yes.
Pinkard's Enlightenment Now. I can't remember the name of the author, but The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I can't remember the name either. Michael something, isn't it?
Probably, yeah. Hitchhiker's Guide. Possibly just doing the first two because I've never made it past those first two.
You haven't?
I started the third one, but I always stall out. Oh, it's just goodness. Too much. And then every time I go back, I think, oh, I should just pick it up where I left off, but I don't remember anything that happened.
We're married. Holy cats.
This is not a surprise. We've had this conversation several times before.
I'm shocked every single time.
I know. I'm shocked that you don't like sewing on buttons.
Yeah, well.
No, I'm not. I'm not shocked about that at all. No one likes sewing on buttons. I'm shocked that Jack doesn't know how.
What was the end? Well, I can't get it tight. Like, the thread sticks out. This isn't important.
All right, continuing on. After Hitchhiker's Guide, Brandon Sanderson's Elantris. I forgot the name of the author, but it's called Guns, Steel, and Germs.
Ooh, I would read that one, too.
Dracula and the Manhunt.
Well, I'll vote Dracula, because I'm already halfway through.
So we'll put Dracula on the list.
I didn't like Dracula.
I think we're going to go Guns, Steel, and Germs. Anything else on that? Lonesome Dove. I'm going to go ahead and call it on Lonesome Dove. Andrew's going to join us for Lonesome Dove. And then Tyson's...
I'll read Lonesome Dove.
Well, that one's going to take a minute.
Lonesome Dove?
Yeah.
Is it long?
36 hours.
It's 945 pages.
36 hours.
I like that you describe it in pages and I describe it in hours.
I'm halfway through, so I'm can be ready for that one.
I think my mother would listen to that episode, though. She liked the television show.
She would listen to anything you did.
What was the Enlightenment one or whatever you mentioned?
Steven Pinkard Enlightenment Now? Is that his name?
Enlightenment, what?
Enlightenment Now.
Enlightenment Now. Okay. Yeah. Never heard of it. I'm looking it up.
I hadn't either. It was a recommendation from Andrew, who was on our previous episode about Ready Player One.
Oh, that's such a good one.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and make the executive decision that the five books that we're going to do next, unless any of them are preempted, will be, and not in any particular order here, Lonesome Dove, Astrophysics, The Hitchhiker's Guide, Gunsteel and Germs, and Dracula. Most likely starting with Astrophysics and Dracula. Any objections?
That can happen.
All right. I'm making the executive decision. That's what we're doing now. All right. Any final comments before we wrap up?
I'm still going to read Manhunt, whether it's voted on our list or not. That's my comment.
Well, if everybody else reads it, I'll gladly talk about it.
Sounds good.
All right. All right, thanks everyone for joining us. Have a nice evening.
Y'all too. Bye.
Good night.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. anovelpodcast@gmail.com or @anovelpodcast. Look forward to hearing from you.